Every time Apple releases a new product, they'll make this video with that guy, the guy with the designer stubble, sitting in a pristine white room with a shiny, elegant new gadget that recognizes your face and promises to become the hub of infotainment in your world. But the reality of how you will use that device is likely to be much messier. Texting in traffic because you can't be bothered with the voice command, or having the stupid ringtone go off in a cinema. This is why Dr. Genevieve Bell was brought into the Intel Corporation, to help software engineers understand that people are messy and they find unexpected ways of using their technology. Now, Genevieve is not an engineer. She's an anthropologist. She studies the way that humans live and interact and use things. She eventually became a vice president of Intel in the US. That's the people who make the chips that go into most of our computers. But now she's back in Australia at the ANU in Canberra. And this year, Genevieve delivered the Boyer Lectures for the ABC under the title of Fast, Smart, Connected: What It Is to Be Human and Australian in a Digital World. Genevieve is hugely interested in artificial intelligence, and she says, we're not going to be quite destroyed by armies of killer robots, because we'll be able to easily distract them with cat videos. Hello, Genevieve.
Hello, Richard.
I was just hearing about this experiment that Google did with these face recognition and cat videos. Can you just tell me a bit about that, what you remember about that?
Yeah, so this is from a number of years ago when Google was building its first machine learning tools. So its first attempt to have computers learn by themselves. So when you hear people talk about artificial intelligence and machine learning and algorithms, what's really going on there is that people are attempting to get machines to learn for themselves, so not be necessarily pre-programmed, but sort of go through large troves of data and start to find patterns. Can it find links inside data? And so in the very early days, Google was building some early kind of what were called artificial brains, or, you know, artificial minds. And they released one of these objects inside YouTube. So it was watching videos, basically. So the computational object got given YouTube to consume. So here is a very big set of data. Go watch videos.
Right. So something approaching an AI is then set off to spend a couple of days watching YouTube.
Yeah,
right.
To see if it could find patterns.
Right.
And it quite quickly taught itself to find the faces of people reliably. And so the people who built this went, yeah, okay, good. Sort of stopped and said, well, what can we do next? What else will it learn if we put it back there? And so the story goes in the valley that they put it back there, and the next thing it did was find cats and cat videos. And so they said, okay, good, you found cat videos, excellent. We're going to sort of reset you and put you back in there and see what happens next. And the story still goes that what happened next was it just watched cat videos incessantly. Now, I cannot speak to the truth of that story. I like it for a couple of reasons. One is that it is sometimes tempting to imagine that these computational objects will be nothing like us. But of course, the reality is we program them and we build in our worldviews and our biases and our logics, and lurking somewhere inside all that computation is us. And so the idea that, you know, first a machine found people and then it found cat videos and then it wouldn't let go cat videos has a certain kind of appeal to it and a logic.
I think I like that AI. I think I want to hang out with that AI because, quite frankly, I've watched too many cat videos in my life too.
Haven't we all?
I want to go back to AI a bit later on, but let's start with the very beginning. You have this amazing childhood story, you do, and it's heavily linked to your amazing mum, who was also an anthropologist. Tell me a bit about your mum and her life of education, her stop-start life of education.
So my mother is an Australian anthropologist. Her name is Diane Bell. These days she's a retired distinguished professor at the Australian National University, but she's had this kind of remarkable career, and I had the privilege of getting to grow up around that. So my mum was a teacher before she had my brother and I. She finished teacher's college and went to become a teacher, had two kids, stopped teaching, came back to then want to go to university, and that was a little bit tricky. Had to go take her university entrance exams, got herself into Monash University, ended up taking anthropology and Australian history, won herself a summer scholarship to the ANU at the very end of her undergraduate degree, and found herself ultimately getting a PhD in anthropology from the ANU. That glosses over a tremendous amount of other things, clearly. It was the 70s. Mum was one of the early beneficiaries of Whitlam's transformation in higher education in Australia. And, you know, she'll sometimes joke that she ended up in anthropology because they had classes when she had daycare. So, you know, my brother and I were quite small at that point, and I have the dubious distinction of being kicked out of my first anthropology class when I was probably about 4 and a half. So I was consigned to
you
the
were
corridor.
Four? You were four? Asking tricky questions in anthropology lectures.
Yeah, so then I was consigned to the corridor with my Vita Wheat biscuits.
What was it that took your family or your mum and you kids to Central Australia?
So mum did her first fieldwork for her PhD in Central Australia. So we ended up living in an Aboriginal community north of Alice Springs, about 350 kilometres north of Alice and 20 kilometres east of Stewart Island.
So it's like near Yuendamu up that's the way?
Other side of the track.
Right.
So at a place then called Warrabri, now called Alikarung.
Right. And what did that mean? What for you as a kid? How old were you when you went there?
I would have been about 8. It's funny, what it means for me as a kid, I mean, it was a lot of things, right? So it was a startling departure from where I had been up until that point. So working class kid in Melbourne and then in Canberra in conventional schools. We ended up at Warrabri, which was a long way away from anything. It was a lot of very red dirt. It was a lot of really different kinds of experiences. People didn't speak English, and there was a lot of pidgin and a lot of Aboriginal languages. There were 4 different languages spoken in that community. There weren't that many Europeans. It was mostly Aboriginal settlements. School was really different. It was a bilingual classroom, so there was an Aboriginal teaching aide.
I try to think of what I might have been like as a kid going into such an experience at the age of 8, you say.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would have detested it for 2 weeks and then felt like I never wanted to leave. Was it like that for you or not quite like that?
It was strange to be in a place that felt really different and had a very different rhythm of things. And, yeah, the first month or so was profoundly alienating. I mean, it just didn't make any sense. But, you know, my brother and I were... My brother worked out very quickly that in order to fit in, you needed to have head lice. So he introduced head lice onto his own head and my head, which resulted in my mother cutting off all of our hair with a carving knife because she couldn't find the scissors. But he worked out that's how you fit in, right, was that you needed to look like everyone else. So the hair went away and, you know, we looked like a little bit more like we were from there.
What do you remember of the sense of the place, like the look and the feel and even the smell of the place?
I remember the smell most, actually. It's funny, I was up in Alice not that long ago, and that's the smell that I really remember most. There is a particular smell to red dirt, and red dirt when it's really, really dry, and then actually when it's really, really wet, too.
It's the iron in it, isn't it?
It must be. I don't know what it is, but it has a very distinctive kind of smell to it. So it was a really dry heat. It was incredibly dusty all the time. It was bore water. If you were lucky, rainwater from the tanks, but mostly a water that had a really kind of metallic taste to it that were inevitably coming out of plastic jerry cans. So a lot of bad cordial. It was, the color was something else again. I mean, it was the bluest of the skies and the reddest of the dirt and just these gum trees, and everything looked different. I mean, it didn't look anything like Canberra. I mean, you'd hardly describe Canberra as manicured, but by comparison, I was wild, and it was scary, I think, as a kid. I mean, these days, I recognize it for a kind of beauty that it had. And I do remember the first time we camped out and I saw the entire of the Milky Way.
Mm.
And there was just, you know, stars from horizon to horizon. It was extraordinary. And, you know, the first time I ate witchetty grubs, the first time I had goanna, the first time I had the deadly nightshade fruit variety. I mean, there was just... It's a very visceral set of memories.
Were you introduced to the land by Aboriginal kids and Aboriginal adults as well?
Yeah, we were really lucky that way. I mean, there was also just a really different kind of set of cultural patterns at work there. So sort of for traditional Walpri and Kaibitch, who were the people that we spent the most time with, when you were little kids, one of the ways you learnt was by watching grown-ups. So you didn't learn by copying and making mistakes, you learnt by watching. And the assumption was at the point you stepped forward, you knew what you were doing and everyone else stepped back. So I remember thinking it was this kind of moment where I got to be incredibly independent. And I remember having an Aboriginal kid on my hip and hanging around with a whole lot of kids my own age and it being a very different sense of personal, not freedom's the wrong word, but kind of just the sense of your own person and it being you. Now, there was a set of complicated social relationships and a putative kinship system, with, you know, skin names, kinship systems, that stuff, but it felt really different. And yeah, I was incredibly lucky.
You learned how to squeeze water out of a frog. You can do that. Like, I'm pretty sure if I tried, I'd end up with this really hideous mess in my hand.
Well, so let's be clear, you shouldn't do this to all frogs. It's a very particular set of frogs and you only do it under a very particular set of circumstances.
Yeah, if you're in real trouble, yeah.
Yeah, so there are these frogs in Central Australia that live deep in the roots of gum trees that dot creek beds. And so in the roots of those particular trees, if you dig down in the sand on the riverside and you go very deep, you will find these handful-sized frogs, brown, a little bit of red marking on them. They fill themselves with a kind of liquid when there are rains, and then they bury themselves all the way down in the ground again. And so if you are desperate for water, you dig for these frogs and then you squeeze them and you drink what comes out of them. I don't recommend it.
Needs must and all that, I suppose. That's the thing, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. But it was also, I mean, I've used that story about I know how to get water out of frogs as a way to introduce myself in America for a long time, because it sort of set the stage for how they might want to think about me, which was carefully.
Do they think we can all do that, I wonder?
No, I think it was always mostly the, like, everything we've heard about Australians is true and they're scary people.
Yeah, that's right. We'll carry giant knives around with us.
Or just frogs.
Or frogs, yeah, in case we get stuck. We don't have water bottles, we have frogs instead in this country. You moved then back to Canberra in the early 1980s. You and I might have been there at the same time. I moved there from Adelaide, and I remember being shocked at the difference between Adelaide's all right angles and Canberra's all curves, and there's huge parts of it which are open bush, and I was really shocked. I can't imagine the shock it was for you to move back to Canberra from Central Australia.
I got taken to the Botanical Gardens on a school excursion, and it was right after they'd just opened the first Aboriginal piece of that. So it was an Aboriginal, like an exploratory walk where you could see, you know, Aboriginal food and kind of encounter Aboriginal ways of knowing. And I just proceeded to eat things because it was bush tucker and that seemed good. This was not good. This resulted in detention and calls to my mother and a kind of general explanation that that's not what we did in botanic gardens,
dear.
Oh,
really? Why? But seriously, why not? What on earth is wrong with taking bush tucker from these trees in such places, I wonder?
It was a botanical garden.
Because
there are rules. And I was not obeying them appropriately. So, yeah, it was a total culture shock. I mean, there was a kind of a notion that you needed to have shoes and things were very structured and you couldn't eat the plant life.
At 16, what were you aiming to be, Genevieve?
I thought I wanted to be Prime Minister. It's an embarrassing thing to say now, particularly because I have multiple citizenships, which I didn't have then.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's out of the question right now.
Exactly, yeah. In this particular moment.
Yeah.
So, listen, one of the things about being in Central Australia when we were there was that it was really clear that I was spending my time with people who had this incredible relationship to their land and who had these awful stories about European colonization. And it was a confronting thing as a kid. And my mum had been really clear with Morgan and I, my younger brother, that you had a moral obligation to make the world a better place, that you were morally obligated to attempt to make the world better than you found it, and that you should be acting on that. And I think when I was 16, I thought politics was the way you did that. And so if you're going to do that, you might as well aim for the top. I kind of could see what that path looked like.
So why didn't you do it?
For lots of reasons. Partly, I went off to university, got a place at Sydney Uni in their first year of their arts law degree program, actually, and turned up for an orientation, and someone in one of the departments there looked at me and went, "Oh, you look just like Diane, my mother." And I thought, uh-oh, like that may be a bit tricky. And, you know, I decided that I was a bit young to be at uni because at that point I really was still 16. And so I deferred for a year. And I was lucky enough in that year to get to go to the United States. And I saw what a liberal arts education looked like. I saw American universities. And I had a kind of moment of wanting that for myself, which was a bit hard.
This was at Bryn Mawr College, which is one of the most prestigious universities in the United States. So
yeah.
You must have been a brilliant student then.
So it was in Philadelphia. I saw Bryn Mawr and Smith in particular, so two of the old women's colleges, so small universities that just took women. I know when I got to Bryn Mawr, gosh, I mean, it was physically really beautiful. It's one of those grey, sort of grey stone buildings and lead light windows and cherry blossoms. I mean, it was stupidly gorgeous. And it was full of these just ridiculously smart women who just seemed so poised and so interesting. And I remember looking at them and thinking, I am so feral and daggy by comparison to this, I can just not even aspire, but I'm going to.
Yeah, but I tell you what, if I'm stuck in the desert in Central Australia, I want to be with you rather than a poised lady from Bryn Mawr, quite frankly, Genevieve. So you, like your mum, decided to become an anthropologist. There must be some... Can you reduce it to some central idea of what you were really curious about that made you want to be an anthropologist?
one of the things about pursuing a career in anthropology is that you'd always be asking awkward questions. And that, you know, part of what attracted me to anthropology and what frankly has kept me in it for, well, 30 plus years, is that it is a way of looking at the world that always produces discomfort, I think, in yourself and in others, but is ultimately this way of making sense of things that's so powerful. It's incredibly seductive at one level.
Well, let me put one theory to you anyway, because this will have relevance for where you go later on in your life. Is it the anthropologist's job, ideally, really, anytime someone wants to construct human lives along straight lines and ordered systems and all that, it's the anthropologist's job to go, but what people really do is this?
Ruth Benedict, who's a sort of one of the senior figures in American anthropology, helped kind of constitute American anthropology. She once said that the job of anthropologists was to make the world safe for human beings to live in, which is a lovely description. So I think you're right. At one level, one of the jobs of anthropology is to just constantly make it more complicated, which doesn't always mean that people want you to be there.
No, but, you know, there's the old saying about, you know, humans are made of crooked timber, aren't they? We're all flawed. We're not like
that. That's a lovely notion. Mm. I haven't heard that one.
Oh, I think it's an old quote that says, nothing was ever built straight out of the crooked timber of humanity. I think that's the old line.
That's a lovely line.
So throughout the 90s, you did your studies at Bryn Mawr. You got 2 degrees. You've got a PhD at Stanford University in California. You're a big rising academic star. And then in 1998, you're in a bar and it all changes. A conversation with a guy in a bar. And it all changes, but it's not the kind of conversation listeners might be imagining right now. It's not that kind of conversation. Please tell me about what happened that night.
So the bar was called Pearls. It was on Ramona Street in Palo Alto. I was there with a mate of mine. She was chatting up venture capitalists. I was just being good, holding her handbag. I'm like, and some bloke says to me, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm an anthropologist." He said, "What's that?" I said, "I study people." He said, "Why?" At this point, I probably should have clocked that he was an engineer, but I said, "Because they're interesting." He said, "What do you do with that?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm a tenure-track professor." He said, "Couldn't you do more?"
Couldn't you do more?
And I thought, yes, I could stop talking to you because you're weird. And so I kind of left the conversation at that because I was just like, I don't really need to be in this conversation and I don't think you could do more at that point. My imagination of where anthropologists went circa February of 1998 was that being a tenure track professor was a pretty good outcome. That seemed like a good deal. And, you know, I was doing archival work and I was really happy and I was teaching. I loved all that stuff. I couldn't imagine doing more. I thought that was how I was going to make a meaningful contribution. And so I kind of didn't really think anything more of that conversation until he phoned me the next day at my house. And among all the other pieces of sensible advice my mother gave me, she told me not to give my number to strange men in bars. And he was clearly weird. And so I couldn't work out how he got my number. So I finally had to say to him, you know, "Who is this?" He's like, "Oh, it's, you know, Rob, we met in the bar last night." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm not interested." It was my first sentence. And he's like, no. I was like, "Well, but how'd you get my number?" He said, "Oh, I called every anthropology department in the Bay Area." I said, "And asked for what?" He's like, "Oh, a redheaded Australian." I said, "And?" He said, "Well, Stanford gave me your name and your home phone number." And then he sort of said, "You seem really interesting." And I'm like, "What does that mean?" He said, "Well, you know, you have interesting ideas." I'm like, "You don't know that." He said, "Well, that whole thing about people, that was interesting." So he bought me lunch and I met his partners. He had a company at that point in the Valley that was making smart paper, so early RFID tagging and e-ink. And, you know, one of them asked me what I thought the future of paper was because he thought paper was going to go away. And I'm like, "Listen, I think paper's a stubborn material artifact." He said, "What does that mean?" I said, "Well, it does more work than just recording things, right? It's actually this kind of, you know, important object." He says, "What does that mean?" I said, "Well, I don't think it's going anywhere." He's like, "Do you know other things like that?" And ultimately, they introduced me to the people at Intel, who at that point in the advanced R&D labs were trying to build up a small social science research team. And they had some cognitive psychologists and a linguist. And they thought maybe they needed an anthropologist, like some kind of collect the whole set. And they didn't have any women and they didn't have anyone who wasn't American. And so I seemed ideal.
What did they want you to do for them?
They had absolutely no idea.
What? Really? What do you mean? Intel hired you as an anthropologist without much of an idea of what they wanted you to do?
There wasn't even a job description. It was also 1998. I mean, that feels like a really long time ago now, but 1998 in Silicon Valley was the middle of the dot-com kind of craziness. Companies were forming around ideas no one had ever heard of. Big companies were trying to work out how to reconfigure themselves. And for a company like Intel, I mean, it had 65,000 employees. It was spending a tremendous amount of money on silicon innovation. One anthropologist wasn't really a big risk.
Okay. So they took a gamble on you might be able to come up with some ideas that they might be able to use.
Yeah.
So when you showed up for work, what happened then?
So having had no job description and no real sense of what I was doing there, and you might reasonably ask, why on earth would I take a job under those circumstances? And for me, it was a kind of moment of thinking, I could keep teaching, or maybe I should be part of this technological revolution where this really interesting stuff is happening, and maybe that's a way of doing something meaningful. But yeah, on my second day of the office, a new boss sat me down and said that my job would be two things. Number one, she said, we need your help with women. When I looked at my new boss and went, which women? And she said, no, all women. I'm like, when you say all women, do you mean 3.2 billion of them? Because that was what it was in 1998. She went, yeah. So she said, what do you want me to do with 3.2 billion women? She's like, I'd be great if you could tell us what they want. So I underline the word women and I write all next to it.
Right. And that's just point one, isn't it?
It is.
Right.
And so if that's point one, it's troubling to think what point two might be. I think I sort of secretly hoped it'd just be men, because then just explain people to us, go.
Right.
But nah, this new boss says, okay, so, you know, women all, sure, but this number two problem, we have an ROW problem.
So ROW?
That's what I said in about that tone of voice. What's ROW? She said, that's rest of world. And I had to take a deep breath and think, I bet I'm from there. And I said, so where's world such that you have a thing called rest of world? And she said, oh, that's America.
Right, America's the world, and it's non-America world, in other words.
And then there's the rest of the world with which we have a problem. And I thought, oh, I know this one. And so then I realized that my job was basically explain everyone to this company.
So when you look at how women use technology, I mean, if that was the first the point one, what do you find? How do you go into the field, and how do you look at that?
One of the things that's very clear when you look at women and technology, in fact, really not just current digital technologies but earlier technologies, is that women have often been the gatekeepers of new technology in the home. It's women who tamed electricity into the homes of Australia and the rest of the world. Women are the ones who worked out how to cook on electricity, what things worked well in a fridge and what didn't. They were usually the ones who remembered to turn off the lights in the rest of the home when no one else did. They were similarly the people who managed the introduction of telephony into the home. And when you get to, you know, and every think of every wave of technology in between now and then, you know, whether it was new forms of domestic appliances, all that sort of stuff. And then when you get to the current wave of technology, women were one of the lead adopters of mobile phones as a group. We still spend more time online than our male counterparts. We are the dominant users of most social media and social networking platforms. We led the adoption and uptake of digital cameras, electronic readers, most online services for banking and healthcare.
So with bearing all that in mind, what's the thing that connects women to that technology? I'm sure that's what they wanted you to know. If the woman's operating the gate, what makes her open the gates to the technology?
So it turns out one of the things about at least Western women, and it's increasingly true elsewhere too, is that the constraints on women's time tend to be such that women don't have large blocks of free time. They tend to have small fragments of time, and they are mostly multitasking across multiple domains.
So women don't have time to study the manual for an hour?
That is correct. Words. So usually the way you look at technologies that women are the early adopters of is it has to work the first time and every time thereafter. And it can't be additive to the stuff you have. It either has to neutralize or subtract something. So effectively, women are really good test beds for new technology. If it gets adopted by women, it will mainstream. Now, the challenge, of course, with all of that is that women do not represent anywhere near 50% of technology developers or designers or venture capitalists or executives in tech companies.
I'm beginning to see the problem here now. Right. So you have women who, the consumers, the adopters, are super pragmatic. It has to work, boot up straight away, like your car starts, I suppose, straight up every time and work every time without having to read the manual. It's got to be super reliable and actually has to have a quantifiable benefit to her or to the household before she'll adopt it. But the stuff isn't being made by women and it's not being designed by people who are thinking along those lines. So
that is frequently the case.
And that's the case.
And, you know, sometimes you'll see it around other issues, right? There's some interesting arguments to be rehearsed about why it is that certain safety features don't exist on social media platforms, that had you had a room full of women going, oh, actually, that makes me feel really unsafe, you might have got somewhere different. I mean, some of it's really simple stuff. When Apple released their software development kit, their SDK for the Apple Watch when it came out.
Software development kit, you mean?
Yeah, SDK. It's for an object that sits on your body. And so most of them were fitness tracking and sleep tracking and activity tracking and calendar-based stuff, right? Nowhere inside the SDK software development kit was there anything for menstrual tracking, ovulation, or fertility. And when the guy who developed the kit was asked about that quite publicly, he said it was a niche usage. Yeah, exactly. So there was a sort of a moment of realizing in that moment, and frankly, I can think of a whole lot of others, where you go, yeah, the development team doesn't actually look like the audience with whom you want to have a success, so you might need to think about that.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
So your two briefs were, one, women. Okay, that's the thing. What do women want? The second one was the rest of the world, with being non-America, essentially. So you went out into the field to see what the rest of the world were doing, which led you to Italy. Tell me what you found in Italy when you went into the field there, please.
Well, one of my colleagues was Italian, and so I basically said to him, will your family tolerate us coming, turning up and asking them what they're doing with technology? He's like, oh my God, they'll be so pleased to see us. We're like, okay. And we picked Italy because Italy at that particular moment in time, so we're talking 99, there'd just been a crossover in Italy between fixed landlines and mobile phone uptake. So there were now more mobile phones in Italy than there were fixed line telephones, which is kind of amazing to think back at that moment in time. And there were a lot of new applications sitting on the phones. Well, we're still talking about Nokia candy bar phone, so they weren't particularly sophisticated. But, you know, it looked like an interesting kind of place. But we were particularly taken by the fact that it was this very early mobile phone market, and we wanted to kind of see what was happening there. Because in 98, there just weren't that many mobile phones in the US. I mean, it's sort of funny. We came back from that trip, and I remember having to explain to Americans how to SMS. Like, they didn't know how to send text messages.
Yeah, we were texting before Americans were, by and large, in huge numbers.
Oh, absolutely. I would give talks where I would borrow someone's cell phone from the audience and show them how you text on the keypad, which it just seems like mesmerizingly odd in retrospect. But yeah, so we were like, okay, mobile phones, that seems kind of cool. And so we go to Italy, or in a small village in kind of northern Italy. And, you know, it is as one would expect. There are mobile phones everywhere. There are fewer computers. There are cyber cafes. And everyone is using their phones constantly to do this kind of micro-location work. So the where are you now? Can we have coffee now?
Like we're doing now.
Like we do now.
Yeah.
And so we took a bunch of photos and we did a lot of interviews and we talked to people about what they were doing with their technology. And we came back from a lot of that work. And I remember having a conversation with a vice president at Intel at that point who was in charge of research. And we were showing him these pictures and talking about the fact that everyone was on the phone all the time and texting constantly. And he just looked at us and went, that is just a phase Europe is going through. And my colleagues and I are looking at him going, you are so wrong about this. But his entire lived experience looked nothing like that. And so we might as well have been describing Mars to him for as real as it felt.
There is this habit in the United States, which Americans think that everyone's catching up to them. And one day we'll all become like them. And the idea that a place like Italy could adopt a technology more quickly and go ahead on one aspect of it just would not have computed, I suppose, with a lot of American people.
No, it didn't. I mean, Australia's got a not dissimilar habit in the opposite direction, right? I mean, I think we aren't always good at recognizing when we're ahead of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I was trying to explain that to someone recently about paywave technology. So the fact that you can tap ATMs on things without inserting them or without swiping them without PIN cards. You can't do that in the US. There is no
really?
No, you can't do that because the banks, there are too many banks to negotiate with. It's a too hard, complicated problem. And there's some issues around, you know, trusted environments and stuff. And so that's a place where Australia is actually well ahead of much of the rest of the universe. But we always think that we're behind. So there's kind of, the Americans often think that everyone aspires to be them. We usually think that we are having to punch above our weight, that we're somewhere, you know, trailing off on the edge of the universe. And Australia has a strong reputation in the tech sector as being an early adopter market. It's a place where you can trial things because Australians are more willing to experiment with new technologies. It's certainly a place where our uptake of mobile phones eclipsed the United States, as did our conversion to smartphones.
Genevieve, part of your research was to look into how people use technology in their cars. And there was a big feature on you in the New York Times about this. Tell me what you were sent to investigate. Because at the time, Ford and Audi and companies like that were putting out visions of the infotainment system that was going to be put in cars. Tell me about how you went into the field to see how people actually really do use technology in cars.
Yeah, so there's a billion plus cars in the world. And at the point we started looking at cars, which was nearly 10 years ago, when you build a car, half of the cost of the car is the electrical system, the technological infrastructure and all the electrical stuff. Most cars have multiple pieces of silicon in them and multiple operating systems that net them all together. So that made them interesting to me. I'm like, effectively, they're computers, just big ones that carry us rather than small ones we carry. So that was sort of interesting. And then I was like, well, in some places in the world, the US and Australia being two of them, we spend a lot of time in cars, and cars are profoundly tied, even if you don't own them, are profoundly tied to how we identify ourselves. You know, not owning a car is a way of identifying yourself the same way owning one is.
Yes, true. That's very true.
We sort of, you know, we tie up with that sort of stuff. So I was like, okay, so they're interesting places. We spend time. How on earth are you going to do field work with cars? And one of my colleagues and I hit upon using archaeology as a way of thinking about them. So we basically excavated cars. And there'd been a study that had been done by some colleagues of ours looking at the contents of handbags as a way of thinking about human beings. So basically getting people to take everything out of their backpack or their handbag and then talk about what was in them. And we were like, maybe we could do that with cars. And I thought, well, if I was going to try that somewhere, where are people going to be willing to let me unpack their cars and just go, yeah, whatever? And of course, the answer is Australia. And I convinced Australians that they should take everything out of their cars, like everything, from the boot, the glove compartment, under the seats, the bits in between the seats, and they should put it all on the ground for me and let me photograph it. And then they should explain to me what it all was.
But you're going there like you're sort of, I don't know, in the Olduvai Gorge or the Serengeti, sort of
unearthing
the artifacts of an ancient civilization. Here's their hand tool. Here's the midden where they...
Here are your five umbrellas. What are you doing in this car?
That fold-up chair you meant to take to the beach, which you've never opened, yes.
Yeah, or the cricket bat and the endless collection of cricket balls or the sticky tape or whatever it was. And so that turned out to be incredibly, actually really interesting in terms of what people had in their cars. And so then we went and did it in a few other places too. China, Brazil, England, Malaysia, Singapore. So we just unpacked people's cars. And of course, what became really clear, unsurprisingly, of course, is that cars are really cultural. So the stuff that is in cars doesn't look the same from one country to another. Singapore, lots of things for parking and umbrellas and red envelopes for Chinese New Year.
Ang Pao.
Australian cars, not so much. But endless green bags for grocery stores, spare pairs of sunglasses, broken technology, water, sunscreen, and alcohol. And then, you know, we always used to do this thing at the end where we'd say, what would you like us to put back into your car? Are you willing to throw anything out? And what was really interesting was people would have agonized about all the stuff that was in their cars, but they put it all back.
Put it all back?
All of it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes even the rubbish. Yeah. I mean, depending on where you were in the world, cars were a kind of a staging place, right? They're sort of like, it's not quite all the way to the shed. It's not quite all of the way to the tip. It's not quite all the way to the green shed. It's not quite all the way to your mum's house. It's not quite all the way to the next place. It felt like this kind of place where certain things were staged waiting for something else to happen. And then there was a lot of just-in-case things. So a map, just-in-case GPS stopped working. Bags just in case you went shopping. And in fact, what was fascinating for us is we started to talk to people about how those cars worked. The way car companies thought about cars was that they were a technological innovation that got you from point A to point B. Like, it's what cars do, right? They're a transportation thing. They're technically sophisticated and they will get you there better. What we realized is that when you talk to human beings, it's not just about getting there, it's about getting there safely. And it wasn't just physically safe, it was socially safe. So the Ang Pao, the red envelopes in the Malaysian and Singaporean cars, were about making sure you didn't turn up at an event unprepared so that you could add money to your gift. In American cars, there was frequently sticky tape, scotch tape, sticky tape, and greeting cards so that you could add something to things. There were all these kind of ways that people were using cars to ensure that wherever you went to next, you arrived there not just on time and physically safe, but kind of socially set up too.
The amount of times I've needed a bottle gift bag. Genevieve, you came back to Australia and I came back to ANU. And I know it's a really obvious thing to say, but when do you want to come back to Australia when you're doing all this amazing work at this high level? I imagine you've been paid extremely well and you've got this incredibly interesting job at Intel and they love you clearly and they value your work. So what made you want to put that behind and come back to Australia to the ANU?
Such a good question. It's one you're not wrong. I've been answering it for nearly a year now. It was partly about wanting to stay true to doing work that mattered. And I've been incredibly lucky in my career at Intel. It had been a very varied one, and I'd had some amazing things that I had gotten to do, and I was doing really interesting stuff. But Brian Schmidt and Eleanor Huntington at the ANU came to me and said, the ANU's at this moment in its history where we want to reinvigorate the notion of a national university. We want to think about how we build intellectual capacity for the nation and how we tackle hard problems. And we think we need to imagine engineering differently. And you sort of sit in that conversation, would you be willing to come home and do that? And I said no. Because, as you said, reasonably, I had a really interesting job and I was doing good work and I kind of, you know, was sitting on the global stage and it all seemed pretty fun. And so I said no. And to their credit, they didn't take that as a reasonable answer and they persisted. And ultimately, through the course of a number of conversations, it became clear to me that actually what was at stake here wasn't just about reinventing a national university that clearly I have a strong relationship to. And it wasn't just about reinventing engineering. It was about how do we create the right kind of questions for the next 30 years? How do we think about what comes next? How do we ask the hard questions about what our future looks like and how do we build the tools for starting to answer those? And I thought, well, I could do that at Intel or I could do that in my own country and in a university setting and with really different co-interlocutors and really different stakeholders. And I think I had the same moment I had when Intel said, come to Intel. And I just went, what's the worst thing that's going to happen here? This will be extraordinary. And so I said yes, and I came home.
And there's the cricket too.
Well, there is the cricket too. Though truthfully, you know, the thing about the internet was that gave me the cricket. I've had the cricket for a few years now. But yeah, you're not wrong. I am a complete cricket tragic.
So you've been doing a lot of thinking and talking in your Boyer lectures about artificial intelligence. And this really fits into the kind of thing you were just saying earlier about what we mean by that. And the kind of people who've been thinking about artificial intelligence up until this point. Tell me what you've observed about that, about the conversation we've been having since Alan Turing, really, about what artificial intelligence is, what it might do, what it might look like, and the guys, and they are guys, who've been having that conversation about what AI would be.
Yeah, so I'm always really interested in giving technology back its history. I think one of the complicated seductions of Silicon Valley is that it makes everything seem new constantly. And that's a wonderful thing, but it's also a dangerous thing. And I'm interested in thinking about how do you give history and context back to things that appear to be brand new.
Yeah, because all these assumptions tend to wash up with the brand new thing, don't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of go, well, where did this really come from? And the thing about artificial intelligence is you can't open a newspaper, turn on a television or a radio without being told that artificial intelligence is here. And, you know, you may lose your job or the robots are going to be here or whatever, right? And it all feels very present, but also very new. And you're right. The reality is we've been talking about theorizing and thinking about artificial intelligence, even using that word, since 1956. So the phrase artificial intelligence was coined at a conference at Dartmouth in the United States in 1956, in the summer of 1956, by a collection of mathematicians, linguists, and logicians, who were looking at the world around them and looking at this incredible set of kind of accelerations of compute technology and saying to themselves, that computing is getting pretty fast and pretty interesting. At some point, we'll be able to teach it to think like us. So what are the problems we should rehearse and set out for it? And so for a summer, they spend 6 to 10 weeks together trying to work through what would it mean to make computational machinery that could simulate human thinking and human cognition.
Now, this is important here to talk about this. Are we talking here about machines that are self-aware, that think in the world like we are?
So this is an interesting question. So one of the things that threads through with the entire history of computing, from the point that computers stop being people, mostly women doing math, and become technical objects, the language that wraps around them, the metaphor everyone uses is always about electronic brains. So the idea is that computers are like brains. So even when it was quite clear that those early machines were nothing like human brains. I mean, really nothing like them. I mean, they were valves or transistors or integrated circuits. The way we talked about them was about intelligence and brains and thinking. Now, the complicated factor in all of that is that we have some pretty contested ideas about how humans work. And so for those guys in 1956, as they are trying to think through what would it mean to simulate human thinking, they've gone looking for some people to help them do that. And one of the places they land is on an American behavioralist named Skinner, B.F. Skinner. Skinner was a behavioralist who was endlessly fascinated with ideas about stimulants and operant conditioning.
So what does that mean?
Yeah, it's good question. He believed that human beings were basically a collection of electrical impulses and that those impulses were triggered by certain sets of things that happened around us and they produced certain sets of responses. And he believed you could condition people to respond differently if you change the stimuli or if you basically trained them to respond in certain kinds of ways.
So there we flip the metaphor, don't we? We go from the computer should be a brain to the brain is a computer and the brain is not a computer.
You are exactly right. Yes. So truthfully, if you were a bunch of mathematicians looking around for a behavioralist who was going to help you think about humans, he's like, oh, you've got one going, oh, wait, pick me. Yeah. And of course, Skinner is writing against and is acting against kind of European psychology at that point. So Freud, Jung, what he would have regarded as kind of all that messy talk about conscious and unconscious and ids and superegos and egos and all that kind of stuff and dreams. So clearly he wanted nothing to do with that. He just wanted it to be a collection of electrical impulses. And his notions about human thinking is really that it is this incredibly straightforward, almost mechanistic thing. And that influences the people who set the AI agenda. Now, that said, there was at least one man who was there in 56 who believed and said something to the effect that if you taught machines to reason, ultimately they would believe. And then you would have to contend with the fact that they had belief systems. Now, that's an interesting proposition and does sort of start to suggest something about can you disconnect thinking from sentience, from consciousness. He clearly believed you couldn't. Turing, who you mentioned earlier, who is a British mathematician and cryptographer, mostly we would know him now for his work at Bletchley Park with the Enigma machine. He built an early thing we now know as a Turing machine, which was basically the skeletal structure of a computer and theorized how computers would work and also kind of theorized what it would be like to have to contend with machinery that was intelligent. And he's one of the early kind of people to say that we human beings would find it difficult to manage with intelligent machinery, that it would be threatening to us. And of course, you know, Turing's got a pretty complicated trajectory and story for himself. I mean, he was a gay man in a time when that was completely unacceptable. He was persecuted and prosecuted for it and ultimately killed himself. And his work kind of falls out of circulation for a long time because of that. So while there had been a lot of the really early kind of important work in theoretical computing that happened in Britain in the war and in the immediate aftermath of the war, it really moves in many ways to the United States in the 50s when the artificial intelligence kind of agenda arises. Now, of course, the thing about AI in that moment in time is that they all go, yay, artificial intelligence, computers, all very exciting. And then, of course, computing doesn't get as powerful and as fast as they thought it would.
It was so terribly disappointing, wasn't it?
Yeah, they're all a bit like, uh-oh, not so good. And so there's a very long period of time when the funding goes away and the computing isn't very good. What is sometimes known as the AI winter. And there were a couple of those where it just didn't go so well. And we are clearly back in a moment where much of the theorizing and notions about what AI could be are now possible in a way technically that they haven't been before, which is partly about advances in computation, but also about the incredible amount of data that now exists to let machines start automating processes and start looking like they were acting under their own power.
So what you're saying here then, correct me if I'm wrong, is that right from the get-go, these conversations that were being had in the post-war years about artificial intelligence were being led by hardware and software engineers, by and large.
We didn't even have people who were software engineers at that point, hardware people.
Hardware people who kind of like the world to run along those straight lines. Or digital world where everything's on and off,
one or a zero or a one.
It is or it isn't. But we don't live in zeros and ones. We live in this messy grey, fuzzy world that lives in between those things. And we couldn't live in the world if we lived in absolutes like zeros and ones. And they found a social scientist that could give them that kind of theory.
And I'm not the first time that's happened, right? Mm. So before artificial intelligence, there was something called cybernetics in the US and the UK. The cybernetic agenda in the US was led by a man named Norbert Wiener, a mathematician, prodigy, polymath. And he spent most of the immediate period after the war, from about 47 to 54 or 55, 1954, 1955, holding these conferences once a year to get people to think about what he called the sort of cyber-physical interface. So he was really interested not in the technology per se, but in what the world would be like when we had to deal with technological objects. And so his notion of cybernetics was this whole system, right? The system of people, machines, humans, animals. And it wasn't about one piece, it was about the whole thing. And when he constituted those conferences, they were remarkable in terms of who was there. So he's a mathematician. They had von Neumann, who's the architect for ENIAC. But Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead were both there, who are American anthropologists, or British and American anthropologists. And so they were, in fact, much more in some ways robust conversations about what it would be like to have these technical objects and about how we should think it through. My suspicion is those conversations were too messy, that people needed to have a technical agenda they could build to, and those conversations just kept surfacing things people didn't know quite what to do with.
A couple of years ago, the second Avengers movie came out, Avengers to Age of Ultron, and I don't know if you've seen it or not, but the premise of it is that there's an AI, essentially, an artificial intelligence, and it's brought into the world by some esoteric technology, and Anthony Stark, who's Iron Man, goes ahead and develops it. And the most interesting part of this movie is right at the very beginning, then it goes pear-shaped. It quickly self-improves. Mm-hmm. Like it's figured out how to re-engineer itself to very quickly self-improve and becomes much smarter and much more powerful. And at that point, it starts to sulk and get angry with humanity and turn on us and want to destroy.
It's not a new story.
No, it's an old one, isn't it?
It is. So sitting inside the Western canon in particular, we have had just so stories about humans making things come to life for a really long time. I mean, next year it's the 200th anniversary of the Frankenstein story. So Frankenstein and his monster, a thing he brings to life using at that point the newest technology, which was electricity. And then he brings a human-looking object into existence and it tries to be like us and we reject it and it then tries to kill us.
Becomes murderous.
But that story in turn is riffing on earlier stories from the Jewish Kabbalistic tradition of the Golem.
The Golem, yes.
Exactly, and of the rabbis of Prague who constitute a man out of clay and bring it to life with the word of God in its forehead and, set it about to protect the Jews in the shtetls of Prague.
But that becomes murderous too, doesn't it?
When it is set about doing the wrong tasks, yes. Mm. And, those stories are all, I think they turn on earlier notions about what is the role of humans in making life, who gets to make life and who doesn't. If you look at Greek, Roman and Egyptian mythology, gods get to make life, but humans do not do it well when they do.
Do you think neither you or I are psychologists, but do you think this might have something in the idea that the worry about our children, like we bring children into the world and eventually they will overthrow us? Really? I mean, that's what's going to happen. Eventually, your kid's going to say, your music is crap, I don't care for your politics, and we're going to do things differently. Everything you've worked for, we're going to put to one side. Maybe that exists. It's kind of a strange expression of anxiety about our children when we create these myths of Frankensteins and golems and Terminators and so on and so forth.
I wonder more if it's about notions of, quote-unquote, the natural order of things, and that, humans can bring things to life in one way, birth. Only gods can bring things to life outside of that. I think in the last 200 years, those stories are as much tied up with our ambivalences about new technologies and what those technologies will do. The Frankenstein story still has currency, bad pun on electricity, but still has currency, whoops, not because of the sort of the running electricity through a thing, but because we have witnessed 200 years worth of technology deployments not having gone exactly how we might have hoped.
So then just to bring it all to a kind of a fine point then, do you see that kind of worry that in creating an AI and putting it in a robot body, it will go on and think for itself and act in the world and maybe hostile towards it? Do you think that's ultimately preposterous then?
I think it is a particular kind of narrative, and I'm really struck by the fact it's not a universal human truth. So if you look at the role and the nature of robotics in Japan, for instance, they tap into a completely different set of stories.
Oh, it's Astro Boy there.
It is.
Astro Boy is the helpful robot, yes.
And the current generation of robots are friendly and pleasant and apologetic and engaged in caregiving. And when you say to Japanese roboticists, aren't you concerned the robots are going to arise and kill you? They look at the last time I had one of these conversations with a Japanese roboticist, he said to me, Genevieve, that's just American science fiction. Like, in Japan, the robots are our friends. Like, what are you talking about? And there was this kind of...
What does this mean, Genevieve, then? If Japanese people can have a completely different take and we see them as kind of helpful angels and we see them as essentially Arnold Schwarzenegger going to kill John Connor, what does that mean? What does it mean?
What does it mean? It means culture matters. It means culture shapes our imaginings of technology. And it means there are moments when it might be good to look to what Japanese roboticists are saying. One of them wrote a lovely book in which he basically argued that robots would be better Buddhists than human beings because they were capable of infinite patience and infinite grace. And he said, wouldn't it be interesting thought experiment? Just don't you laugh. It's terrible.
I know. It's like, I just love it. It's just not, I've never heard that comment. I'm not laughing at it. I'm not trying to make fun. I just think it's such an interesting, and I've never heard robots been spoken of that way.
Well, I think this is fascinating provocation, right? If we always imagined that, we always imagine, this particular roboticist says, listen, the reason we think robots are going to kill us is because we programmed them. And as human beings, we have done the worst things to ourselves in the last 100 years. So, you know, we know the worst things we are capable of, and they are dreadful. And so he says, what if the thought experiment was to say, what are the best things we are capable of? And what would it look like if that's what we programmed into computation, not our worst angels, our best angels? And there's something interesting in saying, okay, not unreasonably, we have 200 years that suggest that technologies haven't always been good, and we've done really stupid things with them, some of them quite deliberately, some of them thoughtlessly. And maybe what we need to do is both pay more attention and scrutiny here, but also ask ourselves the questions about what are we making technical and why, and what would it be to allow that those stories aren't irrational, they have a place, but there might be other stories too.
Genevieve, there are 1,900 things I want to ask you right now. Will you please come back on the show very soon so we can talk about those things?
Absolutely.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Genevieve. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure too.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. All of our thousands of podcasts are available for you for free. I'm Richard Feidler.